Well, do keep that passage open. 30 years ago, if I had said, I am a woman trapped in a man's body, people would have burst out laughing. 30 years ago, they'd have burst out laughing. But today, if you dare to question or deny that statement, you're in big trouble. People think you're stupid or they think you are immoral. Now, how has this change come about? The sexual revolution is part of a larger revolution of the self that has taken place in the West. That is the thesis of Carl Truman in his book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. We live in a world today, he says, in the West at least, in which the individual is king. And specifically, he says, the inner psychological life of the individual is sovereign, is king. So how I feel is king. So I don't need to conform to some greater reality out there, some authority out there. I can be whoever I want to be. And nobody can challenge that. So in sexuality, my gender is what I say it is. So I decide on what is authentic for me. I need to be true to myself. The inner life is king. Or in religion and in spirituality, I assemble my worldview according to what feels right to me. It's a little bit like making your own spiritual pizza. So you take the dough base of something out there beyond the material. You spread on some tomato sauce of Christian love. You maybe add some spicy sausage of Buddhist meditation, mozzarella of mindfulness, olives of sexual freedom, et voila, your own personal spirituality. But such a view of life puts us on a collision course with reality and with Jesus. We are not the kings that we like to think we are. There are givens to which we must conform, and Jesus is one of them. He has authority. It's an authority which brought him into conflict with the religious leaders of his day, and it is an authority which brings him into conflict with our culture and with us. But what kind of authority does he have, and how does it impact me? How does it impact my life? That's what we'll find out in today's passage. So Mark 11:27-12:12, as Jesus goes head-to-head with the religious authorities. And our first point, as you'll see on the outline, is bow down, Jesus has God's authority. You'll see in 11:27, Jesus is back in the temple with his disciples, and the religious authorities, that is the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, they come up and they challenge him. Verse 28, they say, by what authority are you doing these things, or who gave you this authority to do them? Now, when they say, by these things, they mean his clearing out of the temple that we looked at last week, but also everything that has gone before. So the trouble in temple was just the latest in a long line of incidents. So in the first half of Mark's account, we've seen, haven't we, Jesus asserting his authority. He's been asserting his authority over people, over Satan, over sickness, over death, nature, sins, asserting his authority in his teaching and in his miracles. And the religious leaders, they are fed up with it. And so they now confront him. They're basically saying, look, who has given you the right, or what has given you the right, to throw your weight around like this? What is your authority for doing these things? Where's it come from? Basically, they're saying, who do you think you are? Now, those are good questions to ask. They're good questions for us to ask. But in their case, they knew the answer, and they just didn't like it. So you'll see Jesus responded with his own question, and sometimes in dialoguing with people, that is a good approach for us to take as well, to ask questions back. So verse 30, he says, was John's baptism from heaven or from man. You may recall that John the Baptist said back in chapter 1, he said that Jesus was so much greater than he was that he wasn't worthy to stoop down and untie his sandals. And when John baptized Jesus, this is chapter 1, verses 9 to 11, when John baptized Jesus, you may recall, the heavens opened, the Spirit descended on Jesus, and a voice came from heaven saying, "You are my beloved Son, with you I am well pleased." They asked, "By what authority are you doing these things?" Answer, "I'm the Son of God." They ask, "Who gave you this authority?" Answer, "God himself." That was the message at John's baptism. And so the religious leaders were stuck. If they said John's baptism was from heaven, verse 31, Jesus would say, then why didn't you believe him? But if they said it was just from man, they were afraid of the people, because the people believed John was the prophet. And so they say in verse 33, "We don't know." Total cop-out. And so if they won't answer Jesus' question, he won't answer theirs. In this exchange, we are confronted by the authority of Jesus. He is the Son of God. He has God's authority. And so the question for each of us is, do we recognize that? Do we accept that personally? Because if Jesus, if he really is the Son of God, and if he really does have the authority of God himself, that has big implications for us. It means he has authority over us. He has the right to tell us what to believe and how to behave. So the idea that my individual psychological life is sovereign, that is wrong. Jesus is sovereign. The idea that no one's got the right to challenge what feels true for me, that's wrong. Jesus does have the right. So there is this authority outside of ourselves to which we must conform and submit. Jesus is the Son of God. He has God's authority. As Jesus says in Matthew 28, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." So a Christian, a true Christian, is somebody who submits to Jesus' authority. And becoming a Christian, it's not just about downloading a Christian spirituality app onto my phone. It is about a change of authority from me to him. Now, I mean, at work, you are familiar with the idea that you have bosses with authority. You're familiar with the idea that at work there are rules, and you cannot just do your own thing. In society, we're familiar with the idea that there is a government, there are authorities, there are rules, there are police and courts to enforce them. Well, this is saying it's the same spiritually. It's the same in life and in the universe, that there is an authority to which we must submit. Jesus has God's authority. And so we need to bow down before him, and we need to order our lives around him. We need to stop running our own business, and we need to start working for him. This idea of authority is fundamental to what it means to be a Christian. A Christian is someone who submits to Jesus as having God's authority. And so we need to beware, don't we, following the spirit of the age and making the authority how we feel. We mustn't make our inner psychological state king. That's the spirit of our age. Now, we're doing this, aren't we, basically, if we have an attitude of, I'll read the Bible and I'll pray when I feel like it. Or I'll go to church, I'll commit to serving others if I feel like it. And I'll give and I'll forgive if it feels right to me. And, you know, I'll obey when it suits me. Such a mentality is worldly. If Jesus has God's authority, we must go his way, however we feel. And even when we don't feel like it. Otherwise, we're making the authority in our lives our feelings, our psychological state, rather than Jesus. The proper place of our feelings is sometimes illustrated by this train diagram, which is often used in Sunday school, but I think it's good for us as grown-ups as well. It's saying that the engine that drives the train is the facts. So in this case, the fact of Jesus' authority. And we respond to that fact with faith and obedience, and feelings have their place, but their place is as the final carriage. What we mustn't do, but what our culture is doing, is to make feelings the engine that drives the train, to make my inner psychological life sovereign, the authority. But someone might say, well, why does it matter what our authority in life is? I mean, so what if I reject Jesus' authority? So what? Well, 12 verses 1 to 12 tells us, that's our second point. Watch out. Those who reject the authority of God and his Son will be condemned. Jesus tells this parable, this story about tenant farmers, and it illustrates how serious it is to reject the authority of God and his Son. So you'll see the story begins in verse 1 with a man planting a vineyard. The vineyard is an Old Testament image of God's people, for example, in Isaiah 5. So this pictures God establishing his Old Testament people, Israel. And it says he leased it out to tenants and he went into another country. The tenants are the religious leaders of Israel, who in verse 12 perceived that he had told the parable against them. So they are the tenants. Some of you I know have the experience of renting out property that you own to nightmare tenants. Well, welcome to this man's world. Verses 2 to 8 describe how this nightmare unfolds. So the owner sends a servant to get some of the fruit. But verse 3 says they took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And this happens time and time again with other servants. So verse 4. And so with many others. Some they beat, some they killed. The servants picture the Old Testament prophets that God sent to his people and how they were rejected time and again. And so finally in verse 6, the owner sends his beloved son. And verse 8, they took him and they killed him, as would happen shortly to Jesus. In verse 9, Jesus asks, what will the owner do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. And so God would soon come in judgment and he would destroy Jerusalem and the kingdom would be given to others, that is the non-Jews, the Gentiles. And the story ends in verses 10 and 11 with God vindicating his son. So verse 10 says, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, so God would raise and exalt the son that they had killed. That's the story. Now, in the first place, this is a story about how the leaders of God's Old Testament people treated God and his son and what would happen to them. But it's also a story about us. It is a story about humanity, and there are lessons for us. I put three on the sheet. First, to reject the son is treasonous. To reject the son is treasonous. So treason or high treason is when you attempt to overthrow or kill the sovereign. So a bit like Macbeth, if you know Macbeth, killing King Duncan. Or a bit like the plot in the thriller to kill the president. Or like the tenants in this story. By killing the owner's servants and son, they are seeking to overthrow the owner himself, the boss. That is what is going on here. So the owner sends his servants with his authority representing him. The owner sends his beloved son, the heir, to represent him. And so with Jesus. Jesus is the Son of God. He comes with God's authority. And so to reject Jesus is to reject the Father who sent him. It's a big deal. Jesus says in John 15, 23, whoever hates me hates my Father also. So how we treat Jesus, that's how we treat God. To reject Jesus, it's to reject God. It's basically treason against the highest authority in the universe. John 5:23, Jesus says, "Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him." So how we treat Jesus, it's a big deal, it's a really big deal. If we reject Jesus' authority, but we claim we know God, we love God, we're kidding ourselves, we're deceiving ourselves. The two go together. And so secondly, to reject the Son is disastrous. What the tenants do in the story here is completely outrageous, isn't it? The owner's son, he should have been honored, not killed. A despicable thing for them to do. And so the owner's response here is not over the top, it's fully justified. Justice demands it. How much greater judgment will fall on those who reject the Son of God? In AD 66, the zealots plunged the nation of Israel into revolt against the authority of Rome. It was sheer madness. It was a suicidal step. And it brought down the full force of the Roman army on them. And the rebels were annihilated, the people were wiped out, and Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. To reject the authority of the Son of God is even more disastrous. It is to bring the full force of God's wrath down on you. It is not clever. And third point is, it achieves nothing. So to reject the Son is pointless. The tenants thought, didn't they, that by killing the Son, they'd get the vineyard. So verse 7, they say, "This is the heir, come, let's kill him. The inheritance will be ours." And so people have the mistaken idea, don't they, that if only they can get rid of God and his Son, then they'll be free. Free to become God, free to live as they want. But they're as mistaken as the tenants were. All it achieves is their own destruction, and the vineyard is given to others. God's purpose is unstoppable. It can't be derailed. It can't be derailed by rebel tenants or rebel humanity. So the rebels may reject the Son, they may kill the Son, but verse 10, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and this was the Lord's doing. Now you might say, well, if the Son has been killed, how can he become the cornerstone of God's building? Well, the answer is because the Son is raised by God to life and rule. And so rejecting the Son, it's utterly pointless. The story is told, isn't it, of an aircraft carrier that is on a collision course with what appears to be another ship. The aircraft carrier issues a command to the other vessel. Says, "Divert your course 15 degrees to avoid a collision." The answer comes back, "No, recommend you divert your course 15 degrees. Aircraft carrier responds, "This is the captain of a U.S. Navy ship. Divert your course." The answer comes back again, "No, you divert your course." Exasperated, the carrier commander shouts out, "This is the aircraft carrier USS Nimitz, one of the largest warships in the world. We're accompanied by 3 destroyers, 3 cruisers. Divert your course now or else." To which the response comes back, "This is a lighthouse. Your call." Now the point is, we may think that we are some big warship, and we think, you know, Jesus needs to change his course, but he is the lighthouse. And if we are on a collision course with him, there's only going to be one winner. He's the authority. Our rejecting him doesn't change that. Jesus is saying to us, "I'm the lighthouse. It's your call." This week and last week, we've done a bit of door knocking in the local area. And many people are just not interested. They have no time for Jesus. And it can be a little bit unsettling, but this passage encourages us, doesn't it, that people's rejection of Jesus, it does not change reality. He is the Son. He does have God's authority. Raised to life, God has made him the cornerstone, and nothing can change that. To reject him is just to bring down God's judgment on yourself and to have the kingdom given to others. So how should we respond? Well, that's what the final verses tell us. Pay up, give the authority what belongs to them. That's verses 13 to 18. Verses 13, 14, the religious leaders, they send this delegation to try to trap Jesus in what he says. They have this trick question in verse 14. They say, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? So this tax was the imperial poll tax of one denarius. It was introduced in the census of AD 6. And the people, they hated it. In fact, this tax was the trigger. It was the trigger for Judas the Galilean to found his rebel group, which grew into the Zealot movement. So what should Jesus say? If he says, pay the tax, then the people will be against him. If he says, don't pay the tax, then Rome will come down on him. So what should he do? And his now famous answer is there in verse 17. He says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. So first, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Jesus tells him in verse 15 to bring him a denarius. It was a Roman silver coin. He asks in verse 16, he says, whose likeness and inscription is this? They reply, it's Caesar's. So on a coin would have been the bust of Tiberius Caesar and an inscription saying, Tiberius Caesar Augustus, son of the divine Augustus. Now, because the coin bears his image, his inscription, Jesus says it belongs to him. So give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Jesus is affirming here the legitimacy of human government. And we are to give the authorities what is their due. So Jesus was not a zealot. He wasn't seeking to overthrow Rome by force. And so as Christians, Romans 13:1 says, we are to be subject to the governing authorities. Romans 13:7 says, pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, honor to whom honor is owed. So also 1 Peter 2:13 to 17 talks about fear God, honor the emperor. And so Christians can be reformers. We can engage in peaceful civil protest as Joshua Wong is doing with the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong. But Christians are not to be revolutionaries or self-legislators, as some Christians have been with COVID rules. We are to give to Caesar what is Caesar's. But even more importantly, Jesus says in verse 17 that we are to give to God what is God's. So whatever bears the image, the likeness of Caesar, that belongs to Caesar, such as the coin. But whatever bears the image and likeness of God belongs to God. And so the question is, well, what does bear God's image? Genesis 1:27 says, God created man in his own image. It's us. It's us. So we bear God's image. That means that we belong to God. We're like coins on which it says, belongs to the Creator. And so the question for each of us is, are we giving to God what belongs to him? Because the religious leaders weren't. The question is, how about us? Are we? To give to God what is God's is to give to him our whole lives. Romans 12:1 says, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. So it all belongs to him. Our time, our money, our gifts, our bodies, our life. If you don't pay your taxes, what are you? You're a thief. You're stealing from the government. If we don't give God what belongs to him, what are we? We're thieves. We're robbing God. Well, where does that leave us? Let me suggest three categories as we close. First, if you're not yet a Christian, it may be that you think of yourself as a good person. You think of yourself as a law-abiding citizen. You work hard. You pay your taxes. But if you're not giving to God what belongs to him, if you're not submitting to his authority, if you're not giving him your whole life, you're a thief. You're breaking the eighth commandment, It's very clear. It says, you shall not steal. Do you think that thieves go to heaven? God offers us forgiveness through his Son, Jesus Christ, and power to change through his Spirit. Second, if you are a Christian, submitting to God's authority, there is no place for pride. No place for pride. We're only giving to God what belongs to him anyway. But we're just doing our duty as servants. Nobody is a big hero for just paying their taxes. But third, you may be someone who professes to be Christian, but you're maybe a bit like the priests in the book of Malachi. They were offering to God second-rate sacrifices. They were tossing him the leftovers. They were throwing him loose change. Now, that is not giving to God what belongs to him. That is not honoring his authority. It's robbing God. Ephesians 4:29 says, let the thief no longer steal. Let the thief no longer steal. Well, today would be a good day to turn from your life of crime.